Good evening. I think that everyone and anyone who practices our way holds some persistent questions and about their practice. I think everyone, no matter how long really they've been practicing, will ask themselves from time to time, is my practice on the beam? Am I doing this right? Am I directing my effort in the way that I've been taught and the way that is most propitious? If my mind is wandering in Zazen, is there something different I should do at that time? So I really think this is for every Zen student. These are good questions to kind of come up and ask yourself, and they probably do, is my practice on the mark? Is my mind composed in the way that the ancients speak of? Is my practice aligned with the ancient way that has been handed down to us? We have a saying that comes up in several places in Chinese and Japanese Zen texts, and it says a hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement. That phrase is in the Fukan Zazengi, and it's in other places. A hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with a proper attunement. And I think, all Zen students are very familiar with deviation. They have noticed that it's not even always just a hair's breadth, a hair's breadth. that the deviations can vary widely. The standard of deviation is wide, can be wide, or it can be narrow. But the other part of the phrase is it mentions proper attunement. I would hope spark our interest, that we would want to accord with the proper attunement and discern what is that proper attunement. Tsuki Roshi famously told us and taught repeatedly not to practice with a gaining mind, not trying to get some particular thing out of our practice, maybe like a proper attunement. But nevertheless, I would venture to say that he was someone who was actually really interested in what this proper attunement is. What is this proper attunement, and how, and had a wish, had given rise to a wish to be in alignment, to have his life be in alignment and his practice be in alignment with proper attunement, whatever that is. And when I was ordained. Someone gave me a poem, and I didn't look for the poem preparing the talk, but I remember this one line. And the one line is, everywhere, people of the way, everywhere is where people of the way tune their minds. Attune their minds. Everywhere is where people of the way tune their minds. So I think this is a pregnant question for our practice and the record of Zen teaching is replete, actually almost nothing but the interaction of teachers and students who are sincerely inquiring and dialoguing with each other about what this proper attunement is. And so what I'm going to be talking about, I think many people know that this week is a special week that we're setting aside to do more intensive practice. And I'm going to be in this week talking about a certain teacher, ancient Zen teacher and his teaching. And the name of this teacher is Yongshan Huji. And his teacher was Guishan Lingyu. And so Yongshan is, he actually has the appellation, according to the sources, of being called Little Shakyamuni. So seems like a good person to bring up on the week that we celebrate Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, which is this week. This is a traditional week to celebrate Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment. So I'm proposing to celebrate it by talking about the teaching of Yongshan Huji and his teacher in interaction, Guishan. Yongshan was ordained at a very young age. He lived in the 9th century, China. And he was ordained in one place, but then he went, as was the practice then, he went wandering around to various temples, sort of looking for his true teacher. And he, after some years, he found the monastery of Guishan and started practicing with him and became his Dharma heir. So I'm going to start with one story or one set, a dialogue that a question that Yongshan asked Guishan. He asked, "What is the true abode of Buddha?" Guishan said, "Think of the unfathomable mystery and return your thoughts to the inexhaustible, numinous light. When thoughts are exhausted, you've arrived at the source where true nature is revealed as eternally abiding. In that place, there's no difference between affairs and principle. The true Buddha is manifested." Upon hearing these words, Yongshan experienced great enlightenment. I don't know, what Yongshan experienced at that time, but I had the thought that he asked about the true abode of Buddha, and at that time, and when he heard Guishan's teaching, he realized that the true abode of Buddha was not far away, not remote. That's my thinking. So in that quote from Guishan, he says, when thoughts are exhausted, you've arrived at the source. And we have this instruction in our practice, an instruction that also appears in the text by Dogen called Fukan Zazengi. This instruction is to think of not thinking. This instruction comes up in here. It really comes up here and comes up in other places, to think of not thinking. But most of us have realized that we can't command ourselves to not think. You can't order yourself to not think. You can, what is within your power is to hold an intention to not think during Zazen, to not follow thoughts during Zazen. You that is within your power. But what would be an error was to somehow command yourself not to think in Zazen, and somehow beat yourself up if you found yourself thinking in Zazen. What's within our power in Zazen is, when we encounter that we're thinking, is to return to the intention, of thinking, of not thinking. That's something we can do. That's something that's within our power. And that is actually, I believe, the point where we should practice. I have faith that there is a causal connection between our intention to think of not thinking and the realization of the emptiness of thinking. There's a causal connection between those two, but it's not a causal connection that we force or make happen. There's a causal connection, and we can't really see how our intention brings forth the emptiness of thinking, the non-abiding in thinking. We can't really see it, how our intention is doing that, but I strongly believe that there is a causal connection between practice and realization, and that's the teaching of our school. Mystical or something like that. This unseen connection. So our role in practice is just to sit with a strong intention. We can be connected to the process, but not to the result. Arriving at the source where true nature is revealed, that's a happening, but it's not something that we make happen. It's something we could say, Buddha, this Buddha helps us make this happen. Buddha makes this happen. It's not really our doing. It's just our practice to hold this intention. So there are several stories in the various places. The Book of Serenity is one, and then there's also a record of Yangshan that's recorded. And there's several places where we can look at dialogues, such as the one I read, between Guishan and Yangshan, and also between Yangshan and some of his monks. These dialogues have been recorded. And I'm going to be talking during our retreat. I'm talking about this story between Yangshan and one of his monks. I'm talking about it now, and I'm going to be talking about it in the future, later in our retreat. So I want to introduce this story to you, and this story of interaction between Yangshan and one of his monks comes from case 32 in the Book of Serenity. And it's called Yangshan's Mind and Environment. And the case, all the cases in the Book of Serenity, which is a collection of Zen stories or koans, 100 Zen stories and koans, all those cases begin with what's called a pointer. And the pointer was written by Wansong, who is the compiler of the Book of Serenity, who put together this book back, I think, in the 11th century, put together this book looking back at the golden age of Zen, which had just kind of come to an end in the Tang Dynasty. And he lived in the Wansong lived in the Song Dynasty, which followed the Tang Dynasty. And so he, together with Hongzhi, who was Dogen's grandfather teacher, put together the Book of Serenity. And Wansong wrote the commentary. He collected the stories and wrote the commentary, and Hongzhi wrote the poems that go with the cases. So I'm going to read you the pointer, the very first thing that Wansong has to say about the case that is coming. So it goes like this. The ocean is the world of dragons. Disappearing and appearing, they sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. Why does the exhausted fish stop in the shoals and the sluggish bird rest in the reeds? Is there any way to figure gain and loss? So oftentimes these pointers are very hard to understand. It may be maybe that's a little hard to understand just as I read it, but it seemed to me that I had some understanding of this particular one. But we are, as I mentioned, we are entering this week of intensive practice, and the point of this intensive practice is to arouse our way-seeking mind, to vivify our intention and our enthusiasm for practice in the Buddha way. That's kind of the direction we're headed in by sitting quite a bit more zazen than we usually do. We're looking to arouse a Bodhi mind. But we might start out somewhat like a fish, an exhausted fish stopping in the shoals, or a sluggish bird resting in the reeds. So Sesshin is a, among other things, it's a kind of counterpoint to our laziness, the laziness of our practice, right? You know, we let our practice lag from time to time. So, you know, and when we do that, we might find ourselves, you know, the thing about practice is if you do it, you have energy for it. And if you don't do it, you don't have energy for it. So the more you practice, the more energy you have for it. The less you practice, the less energy you have for practice. And that seems to me to be the way it works. You could say that the point of Sesshin is to awaken our freely sporting dragon nature, or our free-flying crane selves, to free our energy for life and practice. And most people that sit sesshins find this is so, that this is actually what happens, that somehow the power of this quiet, concentrated sitting over a number of days has a energizing effect on our lives. And that, as I say, that's kind of the point. And then we have to be careful when we get so energized that we don't, we have to be careful at that time when we, our way-seeking mind is aroused and we're so energetic that we have to be careful not to get too over, or not overdo it too much. Because at that time we can actually step on other people's toes. If we get too caught up in our own energy. So we have to be careful to enjoy the arousing of Bodhi mind without, you know, imposing our joy on everybody else. And so that's kind of like, there's another pointer I would like to offer for Sesshin. So now I'd like to give you the main case that I'm going to be talking about tonight and in the future. It starts like this. Yongshan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "Yu province." "Do you think of that place?" The monk said, "I always think of it." Yongshan said, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, the land mass, buildings, towers, halls and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thought to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there?" The monk said, "When I get here, I don't see any existence at all." Yongshan said, "This is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of person." There's a little bit more to this case, but I'm going to stop there because it's quite a bit right there. And, you know, Guishan had told Yangshan when they were together, as I formally quoted, think of the unfathomable mystery and return your thoughts to the inexhaustible numinous light. When thoughts are exhausted, you've arrived at the source, where true nature is revealed as eternally abiding. So in this story, it's really clear that Yangshan is Guishan's student, and he is carrying on Guishan's teaching when he says, reverse your thought to think of the thinking mind. And of course, this tenet, if you will, is sort of like right in the center of our Soto Zen practice, right? This tenet of reversing our thought to think of the thinking mind. It's right in the middle of Dogen. It's right in the middle of Baijong, who was Guishan's teacher. And it's, of course, Dogen. And the one thing I wanted to say is, although there's going to be actually, I'm sorry to say, quite a bit that I want to say about this case over the next few days, but to reverse your thought, to think of the thinking mind, of course, does not mean to ruminate on your thinking. It does not mean to analyze your thinking. This is not psychology. This is to look back to the source of thinking, to the roots of thinking. It's not a linear kind of approach. This mind that thinks, what is it? What is the original source that thoughts come from? So in his commentary, Wansong's commentary in this case is really wonderful, very, I think, very accessible, very, well, to a certain extent anyway. The beginning part of it is, and then it gets a little bit more murky after that, and the poem is quite murky, but I'm not going to talk about the poem, but in the commentary, Wansong includes a quote from the Sharangama Sutra, which is also called the Heroic March Sutra. And this commentary, this quote, very much, what is it? It doesn't explain the case, but it amplifies the story of the interaction between Yangshan and his monk. And so this quote from the Heroic March Sutra says, when stirring thoughts end and floating ideas vanish, this is like removing defilement from the mind of aware radiance. The whole course of life and death from beginning to end is completely illuminated. This is called ending the cluster of conceptions. Such a person can transcend the defilement of afflictions. When you look into the basis, dissolving illusory conception is the fundamental. So, this is This is the week, as I said, this is the week that we celebrate Buddha's enlightenment. And one thing we could say about Buddha's enlightenment is that he ended the cluster of conceptions. That is the Buddha's realization, to end the cluster of conceptions and not then have his life be driven by conceptions. So he realized freedom from conceptions. He ended the cluster of conceptions. So whether you're, you know, sitting this sesshin or not, you might think that this week, you might keep in mind that this week is a week to celebrate the arousing of the Bodhi mind. And it's a week where we might encounter the sporting dragon nature in ourselves and in other people. You might see it appear in yourself. That nature might appear, or you might see somebody else and you say, "Oh, I think that nature has appeared over there in that other person." I think I see something about the way they're sitting. I see something about the way they're serving the meal. I see something about the way they're drinking their tea that lets me know that their free-flying crane nature has woken up. This is, you know, kind of a point. Let's do this together. And whether you're sitting or not, just think of us who are, and hopefully, you know, you'll get that contact high of knowing that not just here in Sacramento, you know, but all over the Buddhist, you know, well, Japanese Buddhist world. So in Japan, many places, they'll be sitting Rohatsu Sesshin this very week. And this very day that we celebrated on the end, the 8th, will be the day that they celebrate. And sanghas across the country will be sitting this week in various formats. And so, you know, there's a way to think about the, you know, this kind of joyous spiritual event that's happening this week. And it's shared, a shared spiritual event that's happening here and elsewhere. So that does, concludes my talk tonight. And if you have any comments or questions, we can have about 10 minutes for that, if you like.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim. Early in your lecture, you said something to the effect of the benefit of thinking or not thinking, or holding the intention to not think, opens up to opens the mind to the emptiness of thought. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that's right.
Could you expound a little bit more further on what you mean by the emptiness of thought?
Well, you know, during Zazen, I spoke about the ocean. I spoke about how, you know, the ocean, the deep ocean, not being disturbed by the waves and the wind, all the activity that's going on the surface of the mind. So the way I would talk about it is like that, that even though there might be on the surface of the mind, there might be some thinking activity, there could be, but there could also be a kind of recognition that that thinking activity is just wind and waves. It has, and it's, so what is it? Wind and waves are impermanent. They're without a self. They just come and go. And that's the way thought is as well. It's impermanent. It's without a self. And beneath that, the activity that is the apparent activity, there's an understanding that that's just apparent activity. There's just apparent activity going on, and I'm not identical with that apparent activity. I am not that. I am not that apparent activity.
Because it has its own causes and conditions?
Because it's ephemeral. Because it's not something that can be relied on. It's not substantial. It doesn't have any own being. It's fluff. It's like wind and waves. It's going to come and it's going to go. So to sit in awareness of that, and is to sit at ease, and not be caught, not be not grasping the thoughts, and not be grasped by the thoughts, to sit at ease with that activity, and the longer you sit with that. At ease with that activity, the less power that activity has over you, and the more your true spirit, your true nature can flower, can bloom, can be available to others, and joyfully interacting and being with others. So that insight into the emptiness of thought is really the, well, this is Bodhidharma's understanding, right? Nothing holy, vast emptiness.
I forgot exactly who said it, but I recall one of the ancients suggesting that you can have 89,000 thoughts. It's no problem as long as you don't hold on to them.
Right. That's another description of the ultimate emptiness of thinking. Thank Not you. That thinking isn't useful. Thinking can be very useful. This is not a recommendation to stop thinking. In your life and taking care of Dharma centers and fundraising and all the things, but it is there was a statement here that I thought one shouldn't overlook. Uh, When Guishan was talking to Yongshan about the true abode of Buddha, he says, when thoughts are exhausted, you've arrived at the source where true nature is revealed as eternally abiding. In that place, there is no difference between affairs and principle. So you can do both things. You can take care of Dharma centers and fundraise and, take care of your life and see your grandchildren and you can also, pay attention to principle, the fundamental principle of, our life. The bedrock of our life, the true nature of our life, and there's no difference, and seeing no difference, and really living no difference, so that when, you're taking your turn washing the dishes, it's no different than when you were in sitting zazen, You're just affairs are happening, principle is happening, there's no difference. And that's, that's kind of like merging or wholeness that we foster, we foster in our life and practice.
Form is emptiness, emptiness is form.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is that Todd? I can't see in the corner.
Yes.
Todd.
Yes, I was thinking.
Yes.
Doing a lot of thinking as you were talking about Yongshan and his dialogue with his teacher. And it has always bothered me when they end a dialogue saying, and he was greatly enlightened. By these simple words, right? I just don't buy it personally. And so what I'm thinking is maybe this is the first time I know it's bothered me for a long time, but what I'm thinking is he saw in his teacher, he heard his teacher tell him back his own truth. He was reflecting to him an experience that he had already had. What do you think of that?
I think it's very close. I think I have the same feeling that I think when that you could, if it said, Yongshan was greatly confirmed, his understanding was greatly confirmed by those words, it would be this very much the same thing that he already had that understanding and. He just recognized it in a kind of very eloquent form. I mean, he was impressed by the very eloquent form of the teaching he received. But it just confirmed what he already was in his body mind. I agree with you.
Thank you. I feel so much better.
Let's see, Patrick.
Hello. I have a simple, or maybe not so simple, I don't know, zazen question, related to what you've been saying. Usually when I'm sitting and the thoughts arise, I try to bring it back and use that as that, moment of realizing thinking. But is there ever a time when sitting that maybe it's useful to stay with a thought and follow it through? And I'm thinking of, sometimes those kind of like aha moments that when you're sitting just kind of come up, maybe related to a teaching or something that, you read related to Dharma, things like that. So I don't know, is there ever a time where it's a good thing to stick with it and see it through to the end of the thought, or should you still kind of just realize that that's, still a thought and just let it be?
Well, you're talking, I think, about the attractiveness of insight, perhaps, that mm-hmm. you maybe, for me, it happens if I'm studying Buddha Dharma, if I'm studying, for instance, this case, which I've been studying intensively, reading this case several times over again, and then in Zazen, insight about the case, some explanation to myself about the case comes. And oftentimes the words are attached to that insight, and then I will, at the end of the period, I will get up and I will write something. I will write it. And so I can't say, you know, banish all thinking, or banish, I certainly would never say banish your insight. But also, you know, be careful, you know, to say, you know, is this, if I'm indulging something, you know, and I mean, when I was a young Zen student at Tassajara, I was the head gardener, and I would sit in Zazen in the Zendo, and I would think about, you know, the plants and the work I had to do and the tools I had to do it with, you know, and that was too much, you know, that was just really too much. You know, you just have to be honest with yourself. I think that's the main thing, you know. I think you can recognize the difference between just drifting mind, which I would always suggest cutting off, just cutting it off, and insight, which is definitely worth paying attention to, definitely giving, not forcing away in some way. But actually, you know, letting yourself enjoy it. And if it's words, you know, maybe write them down after Zazen. And those words, you know, could be a source of help to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Scott?
I just want to bring up something that I know that sometimes happened in my own practice about that is. Is that better?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sorry. You know, in my own practice, I'm sitting with thoughts and living with that thought process as it arises, is that it's possible to develop this kind of attitude toward thought where it's actually kind of adversarial.
Mm.
Where you actually, I think this is possible, because I know it is in my own case, that in the striving to attempt to transcend thoughts, that when thoughts occur, there's a certain adversarial aspect to it that, you know, that can be there in one's relationship to thinking, mm-hmm. thoughts itself. And I just wondered if you could address that a little bit.
Well, I think you already know, but I can confirm that I wouldn't recommend getting in an adversarial relationship with the thoughts. I would recommend noticing thinking and then it's always helpful at that time that you notice drifting thoughts or adversarial relationships. It's relation to the thoughts, it's always helpful at that time to return to your body and return to your breath, return to the physical sense of sitting, you know, the embodied sense of sitting, and bringing yourself back into contact with Vipassana, mindfulness practice, the temperature of the air, the feeling of the breath as it goes in your nostrils, whatever it can take to bring yourself back into the body versus, whatever debate or hostility or is going on in your thinking. So I think that's, that's oftentimes that's, and after a while, I think you probably noticed this, that your body itself will kind of call out to you and say, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. That's where you're, Your life is here in this body, so pay attention to me. And you'll have that experience too, where your body just calls out to you, and you notice at that time, you notice your breath, right now I notice my breath, coming in and out, and it's sort of like being saved in that moment, to return to your corporal identity. It's hard for a person with an okesa on to get up and then get down again.
Saved by the kindness of somebody. Have you, Sean? I think you said, I don't have the exact words, towards the beginning, that we're invited to not just notice the content of our thoughts, but to notice what the mind's doing. Something like that. What is it that the mind's actually doing in this creation of thoughts? Something like that. Is that...
Well, going to the source of thinking. Yeah.
Right.
And that's an aspiration, It's just a direction. That's all it is. It's just a direction. It's not a place you go.
Well, right. Well, yeah. I guess what ended up happening for me in response to that invitation was kind of realizing that earlier today I had an interaction with somebody, and then in my zazen, I'm thinking about that interaction, and I think that, I've discovered something really meaningful about that interaction. And then I saw my mind trying to plan how I was going to tell that person that awareness. And then it was sort of like, pop, look at that. Those are just my thoughts. And if I stay with them, I'm going back into the past. I'm no longer in the open present. And so to totally let go of all of that, I realized that whenever I see that person again, everything will be open. All of that is, it's like my experience, but it's not back there anymore. It will function in a different way in the next moment, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very like pop. I'm back fully here.
That's wonderful. I recommend pop practice. Pop back to here and now.
Another question on Zoom.
Okay. We have Brett on the line. It's almost midnight where he is, so let's be kind. you can go ahead. Who was it? Is this Shalema? I can't see.
Yeah, Shalema.
Shalema. Hi, Shalema. You had your hand in your mouth.
Hi there.
So this is holding the intention seems, when I'm sitting, might seem a bit weighted for me to sit with with any intention. So I was just wondering, is there like so one thing that really helps me is to come back to my body, to take some breaths, and that seems to kind of clear my mind. But I'm just wondering about sitting in Zazen with a held intention or intentions versus, you know, the activity of sitting. It seems like I would be in my mind if I sat with intention. Maybe I misread what you were saying. I misunderstood, Jim.
Well, no, I don't think so, and I understand where you're coming from. I think the intention is not a command or something to yourself or an admonition to yourself. It could be, especially, you know, sometimes it could be, but it just be the intention. Eventually, well, there's a phrase, you know, called your inmost request. And maybe that's a better word. Maybe that's a better phrase than intention. Your inmost request. Well, what is your inmost request? And maybe if you think, well, is what I'm doing now in line with my inmost request, or do I think not? Do I think this really isn't in line? You know, I'm thinking about, you know, what I'm going to have for breakfast. So I think that might be another way of thinking about it. You know, that intention is just what is in line or what is aligned with my inmost request at this time.
Okay.
We're, you know, and you know, you don't have to follow anything I say. You follow your own, in, you know, your own light. You know.
Sure. Thank you.